Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, you know, joining us, a repeated founder. You know, right now he's riding a rocket ship. You know, they're like growing like crazy in different countries, different currencies. But again, what he's done is remarkable. Not only they've raised over $70 million on the equity side, also over $200 million on the debt side for their operation. But we're going to be talking about how bumpy, you know, the first years were, you know, whether it was Corona, you know, partner issues with one of the partners that they had. Also, how to deal with fast growth when you are especially tackling a very heavily regulated market like they are doing. And then also, how do you go about the whole thing on building, scaling, financing, and beyond? So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Malte Rau. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So originally born in Berlin. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up in Berlin?
It's more like from stories. I lived here till I was 10. So I actually don't remember, but my dad told me like I was there when the wall came down. So I was actually like 1 year old. So that was quite interesting. But the time after, I can only talk about the kind of vibe the city had once the wall went down, and was pretty amazing according to my dad. But for myself, I didn't remember too much. I think that parts of my life after Berlin, when I moved away when I was 10, was a little bit more shaping my character than the first 10. But I wish I have more stories from actually that supposed to be an amazing time.
So obviously you moved to at 10 to spend the youth and graduate high school a little bit away from Berlin. I'm wondering too, how was that, you know, process of being in a different place, making new friends, dealing with the uncertainty? I'm sure that shaped you up quite a bit.
Maybe. I compensated with a lot of chocolate, to be honest. So I gained a lot of weight with the age of 10. So when we moved away, it was for the job of my dad. And from that point on, kind of have to, you're kind of unrooted, right? So your roots are still in Berlin, but then you're moved away. So I think it needed a lot of adjustment and took some time to adjust to it and find your place again. But I think with this experience, it also shapes you maybe in good ways, maybe in some parts you only discuss in therapy.
It sounds like the world of consulting, I mean, you studied economics and management, but it sounds like the world of consulting is what really got you hooked to start off your career. What was it about consulting that got your interest?
Yeah. I think like generally when I picked the subject of my studies, I wasn't too sure exactly what I wanted to do. I always knew I like numbers. And then after studying, I spent some time in an internship abroad in the US, and coming back, consulting sounded like the best option, because if you're not 100% sure, the ever-changing projects in consulting and these kind of things were a very good way into the job market. You could still figure out a little bit where you wanted to go. And I got kind of hooked on the risk management side of things. So I didn't plan on becoming a risk manager or someone who spends a lot of time in data. But this is where after, like 2 years after the financial crisis, there was a lot of demand. And so I ended up at KPMG crunching some numbers for some banks in Germany. And yeah, I think it was a coincidence at the same time, but also lucky to go to be at the right time at the right place.
So, I mean, you actually work for big companies like KPMG and so forth. So what was it like, you know, like to really, because here what you were doing ultimately was like risk management. You know, it sounds like that was the specialty that you developed. So how was it like, you know, like going through all these different organizations and taking a look at risk management? I mean, what's that about? Because I mean, right now you're a founder, it has had nothing to do with risk management. It's all about taking risk.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true, right? Sometimes I'm joking also, I'm a risk-friendly and not risk-averse risk manager. There's not that many, but I still think it shapes you a lot, because in a way, what you do also when you play with this data, you still have to see like what are kind of the worst case scenarios, what is the outcome you like to prepare for. So these kind of things were for sure very early on experience that helped a lot to shape your mind, to think also, to be prepared for other scenarios. But of course, it moves very slow. It was big banks we worked for, so still this project took some time. We had impact, but at the end, also as a consultant, you usually leave after the implementation. You don't really see it bearing fruits. So in that regard, I think it was good to train your brain to think in a certain way. And nowadays, I still think back a lot, how did I approach it in a larger corporation and got my own learnings out of it. But there was also a reason to leave at some point in time.
So then let's talk about to getting into the whole world of lending and then also Rocket Internet and the world of startups. Tell us about how you did that shift into something more specific in terms of industry.
Yeah, so it was also a little bit of coincidence. It wasn't fully planned at that point. I was still thinking about kind of the partner track in a consulting environment. But a former colleague of mine left KPMG to join a company called Aux Money. It was still quite early stage. And when we had a conversation when he was leaving the consultancy, it just sounded very interesting. I said, like, hey, cool, whenever you start hiring, building a bigger team, give me a call. And 2 years later, or 1.5 years later, he actually did. And this is how I got involved in this idea of leaving for a smaller company. So then I took the step. I never looked back because it was very exciting. And the impact you have in a startup when I joined was like around 30 people. It was really nice to see. And you really had to train different muscles when you build lending capabilities as well as risk management for early on startups. So when you do that, you have to think completely different because you don't have a big bank in the background, and you will learn quickly that usually banks are paid first and not fintechs, these things. So when you just adjust the models that you have in banks, they don't work in fintech. So that was quite interesting. And it was a company focused on consumer. Afterwards, I went to a company that did similar things, but more on the SME lending side. So slightly different again. They don't necessarily have as much data, but also very interesting. And Rocket Internet was the company that incubated. And after that company was sold to ING, I joined Rocket directly to build a venture debt fund that focused on refinancing fintechs with lending operations, which was kind of closing the gap or the loop a little bit to also help provide the liquidity a lot of these lending fintechs have, due diligencing what they do every day. And it was quite easy once you have been on the other side beforehand to do the diligence. So the other way around.
Well, I mean, Rocket Internet, you know, at that point was also booming. So I'm sure that
yes,
gave you
sure.
great exposure on things that work, things that don't work. So I guess what kind of pattern were you seeing on the things that were working?
So for me specifically, I mean, we had some touch points also with the equity arm, but we were a little bit disconnected because at that point Rocket had or was sitting on, I think, 2 billion in cash and said like, well, I think we can't spend it all on just equity. So let's build also a debt practice. So we, of course, swapped deals or when there was already Rocket investment, that was a way of building pipelines. But we didn't have the mandate that we basically have to do the refinancing just because they're also an equity investor. But what we saw is that there was still a lot of potential of, I would say, generating above market returns when you have access to early on startups with the backing and a brand of Rocket, where people even consider like taking higher prices for a better brand. So that was one of the parts, but from a pure lending perspective, I think we did an amazing job when it comes to just the pure returns and like basically mitigated all defaults. So that was interesting. I think by now, as everybody knows, Rocket is shutting down most of their things, and the debt practice was also one of them, and it turned into different focus areas than just fintech. And that also the point when I thought, okay, seeing the investment side, I think it's time to venture out, do my own thing, start as a consultant myself, but then always with the aim to also found a company.
So then let's talk about that moment where you decide to take the leap of faith and venture out and start your own thing. How did that unfold?
I think first, like, I mean, I wasn't like the youngest founder, I would say. When I started that, I was always above 30, and I took some time to also study what I think was like the success or the area of success that the founders I've met by then really excelled at. And at some point, I just had the feeling, well, I'm not really learning more from these like very good founders at the current stage. So that gave me the comfort to really take the leap of faith. And also at the same time, you, of course, start with an idea, talk to angels, talk to people you worked for. And I think the biggest push or compliment I got was simply that from all parts of my life beforehand, and that CV in general from every part, someone wanted to invest because they trusted in my judgment, even though the first company, that was not the right judgment to invest. But I think that was especially the part where if you have peers that also push you, I mean, you can have a lot of things in your head. But of course, once people are willing to give you money, that's quite interesting. But also learning from that experience for the second company, that when we actually were able to pay back most investors during that first company, but some said, you don't have to do that, you know, and that was also a big aha moment. So that even you have it, and angels invest, they also do some, they have usually even the higher risk profiles and like pre-seed investors, but also the bigger returns. But that was, I think, also a big learning, but you gain a lot of confidence if people trust you with their money.
No kidding. Know you. No kidding. Now with this first venture, obviously, you know, as they say, you either succeed or you learn, right? Yeah. And this company, basically what you guys were doing was basically risk management solutions and more in the open banking, you know, data world. But mm-hmm. you either succeed or you learn. I guess things didn't unfold the way that you had hoped for. So what happened there?
Yeah. So for us, of course, we saw that there's a lot of opportunity. There's this new data source that's super relevant for risk management. Also something a lot of fintechs early on just utilized to close the information asymmetry they have towards banks to really be able to also convince customers to use their loan products. And at that point in time, this way of underwriting was not really available to banks. And the overall interest was there. The part that I would say kind of killed the company was simply the sales cycles, right? If you're younger, you haven't sold anything to a bank yet, which of course first say, oh, this is super interesting. And then you sit there the first year, wait for the budget for the second year, it doesn't work out. And then at some point you just have to say, yeah, I guess this won't work out. And also if it was a little bit early, I would say, because you see now that similar business models are taking off or are quite successful. So overall, sometimes it's market timing, but also like for me afterwards, it was the point where I said, well, I might not want to do or found another company. It took a lot of convincing from my mentor to say, hey, you should try it again. It happens. I think that's something that also shapes you also though for the others, for the next step where you have these learning moments like, well, you don't have to really return the money. That gives you more confidence also to take even a bigger risk, I'd say.
What was that point for you? I'm sure it was a massive when you decided it's time to pull the plug here on this opportunity. And what was that reflection journey? Because I know that there was a mentor that was the one that had to give you a slap across the face, you know, sort of saying, hey, Malte, let's go. Pick yourself back up and keep it moving. So I'm sure that was quite an experience and very transformative for you.
Yeah, I think it's like two points in time, right? The first one is really you see it coming, right? It's not that you try to cling on a little bit, but then once you actually take the decision, it's actually a relief, which is a lot of people always say, yes, it's very stressful, but if you know, okay, this will come, but once you have taken the decision, everybody's informed, it can also be a factor of relief. And I still had some time also to do some projects in between, like to keep me busy. And the biggest really pivotal moment was also this communication of that one angel. Well, like we invest, we know the money is at risk. And then the mentor, who's Fayon from Aux Money, the CEO there, who also hired me like very early on, he clearly said, well, I know you have kind of the talent, right? I needed some build up. Didn't necessarily need a slap across the face. It was more like, okay, here I can support you. I'm sure this will work out. Help me shape the idea, even help me fundraise. Because I said, like, I don't want to go out. Like, basically, I had like everything provided to me. And that was such an amazing experience. And it wasn't like it wasn't my own drive. Like I needed someone to drive me, and now I'm driving myself insane. But then that's kind of the story behind that.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then talk to us about how the idea for your newest baby, which is a rocket ship, how did it, you know, come together?
Yeah, so we, at that point in time, when we decided to found the company, my co-founder and I started to look, especially in the card space. It was already quite hot space, to be frank. So there was already 7 companies in that space, and we still saw that there's a big gap in the market, even though it seemed quite busy for a lot of investors, because there were already so many companies that already have raised even their Series A, and we were the new kid on the block. I wish that we would have had the romantic story that we suffered from bad credit cards. Actually, it's more that we fell in love with the technology, the complexity. So I'm always saying that we are more a bunch of nerds rather than the inspired people that found a very special way. We just saw there's a lot of opportunity, meaning that a lot of these providers focus on direct business, and we have chosen a path where we rather enable others and a different way with partners into the mass market, rather than trying to be the dominant brand and these kind of things. So I think that was an interesting approach to the market, and at the same time needed a lot of convincing of VCs or investors also that you don't have to be either or, because we have direct business and indirect business. But nowadays, I think looking at our P&L, they're happy, because actually that is a very good approach to save marketing expenses.
So then, tell us, you know, what ended up becoming the business model of, how do you say it well? Because I have the Spanglish kicking in. Pilot?
Pliant.
Yeah, you see, yeah. You know, my accent sometimes, you know, gives me the hurdles. But with Pliant, what ended up becoming the business model? How do you guys make money?
Yeah. So Pliant is a B2B card issuer. So cards most of the card providers have 2 revenue streams. One is, of course, you offer also software around the card that you can charge. For us, the main revenue source also is the interchange fee, meaning that if you use a card at the merchant pays a fee. In the business space in Europe, it's not regulated or kept like the consumer card. So this is why there's not that many consumer cards in comparison to the US. And with that, you then make around, an average maybe 2%, and the US is actually more that you make per transaction, but that's a big revenue stream, and your customer doesn't really have to pay for it, and that's the main revenue driver for us.
I know that the first years too of the business were a little bit bumpy. You know, we're talking about issues with coronavirus, you know, lockdown, also issues with the partner that you guys, you know, were dealing with. You know, I mean, it sounds like it was full of adrenaline.
Yeah, adrenaline is good. It's a good way of dancing with the black swans.
No kidding.
So yeah, we actually, like, when we started raising, we started in February, and then the lockdown happened. We had term sheets, they were withdrawn, right? It was the first lockdown. It wasn't like, well, money's free now. was still the phase where, like, I don't know if the world is going to end. So that was tough. And we then still got a term sheet from a family office. And we thought, okay, this is amazing because we're the only one who can raise right now. And then we decided to take the money and start working on it, which if we would have waited a little bit, I think the money afterwards would have been cheaper again and maybe a more interesting cap table at that point in time. But so we went for it and then started working, hired our first 7 engineers. We were a team of 10 at that point in time. And then 2-3 months in, our lovely partner Wirecard decided to be the biggest fraud in the German stock exchange that has happened so far. And that was the point in time where after 3 months of burn, you're there, have no setup. So basically, we were quite close to say, like, guys, do you want your money back now? But I remembered also they don't necessarily need it. But at that point in time, then we continued to push on and decided, okay, we are still going to finish the product. We're going to search for new partners, which was not easy. And we came to the next point where then we didn't have enough money to go live. So we had to raise 2 pre-seeds, which luckily worked out in the end. But those are not the easy fundraisers. And you take your cap table gets messy. Let's put it that way.
No kidding. So let's double click on that. How much capital have you guys raised today? Because I know you have the equity side and then also the debt side.
Yeah. Yeah, so on the equity side, a little bit more than 70, so 70 million in USD. And on the debt side that we need, especially for refinancing of our card receivables, around 200 million, which we are not fully utilizing, but that we have committed and that we can use to scale our business, especially for the part of the customer base that is high spending and needs credit lines in the millions. And that's the base for that. And we continue to raise even more, especially debt, because there are so many cash requirements you have as a fintech. Sometimes it's just sad.
How was the journey too of going through the motions and the different cycles and, you know, again, for raising all that money?
I think the initial one, besides like Corona, we always felt that we had the time where it wasn't the best timing, because then when we didn't raise, everybody's doing the big rounds and other existential fundraise, I would say, was then end of 2022, where we absolutely had to raise. And we actually closed early 2023. But we talked to 150 VCs. I would say 99% said no and also said, well, similar story during Corona. We don't know where this is going. We want to sit it out for now. We focus on our own portfolio. But then we were lucky to find one investor in Japan, SBI, which is quite active actually also in Europe as a fintech investor. But we had to fly for a 20-minute meeting to Tokyo for the final IC. So that was also a nice experience. And they even decided on the spot, which was interesting. But then with our term sheet, we landed and had our Christmas party.
Wow, that's incredible. And what's the difference too? I mean, you were alluding to it on a company like this between raising equity and raising debt. And how do you go about what's different from raising one approach or the other approach?
Yeah, I think for me, coming from the debt background, debt is a little bit easier just because it's very rational and it's very number driven. So you just say, like, well, this is a loan book, this is data. Yeah, do you like to finance it? And usually it's not as hard if your loan performance is great. But then for equity, being like selling a vision and these kind of things, that as a data guy is a little bit harder to wrap your head around. So there's also a lot of coaching feedback on decks that were required. And I still feel that our deck is to this stage not as easy, not as visionary in comparison to what we are actually doing. So it is for me a skill set that I for sure need to even get better round by round. But whenever we raise our Series A, looking forward to the first fundraise in a more relaxed environment.
and obviously, you know, when you're a startup, not only you have to deal with the uncertainty of, you know, going through the hoops and the fast growth of being a startup, but then also in your guys' case, you know, dealing with regulation. It's a heavily regulated, segment. So how do you go about the uncertainty of both?
Yeah, first of all, wasting a lot of money on lawyers. No, I shouldn't say wasting, but there's a lot of the money. The first people who make money with fintechs are usually lawyers, especially in the regulatory environment that we are in. But initially, we had literally to have one partner for the cards, one partner for the lending. So you had so many partners and vendors to manage that there is a lot of time investment. And also all these discussions about like who is allowed to push this button, or should this be allowed regulatory, like regulated entity or not? So it gets really to the nitty gritty details where even before, if you have worked in regulated spaces or even fintech, sometimes when you have to build yourself and start talk to lawyers, where it's like one sentence in your TNC that when then the regulator could claim that you need a license for this, this is really what it gets down to. And you have to triple check everything. And usually all our legal projects are cost at least double from what we initially think.
No kidding. So let's say you were to go to sleep tonight, Malte, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Pliant is fully realized. What does that world look like?
So our hypothesis, the way we go to market, is clearly that best-in-class software and banks win. Sounds maybe not as inspiring as some other visions, but this is the way we position ourselves. We think that business relationships or businesses have a very strong relationship with their bank, which is a harder bond than having a millennial checking out a new neobank. So therefore, we want to position, enable, bring the technology to banks so that everybody can utilize or benefit from digital cards that we offer. So we think that if that happens, continues to happen, of course, hopefully they also buy our services, but then we are positioned very well. And that would be not a dream come true, but I think that would be the world where we would excel specifically.
So I know too that you guys have been, again, alluding to the growth earlier, and as part of making this like a mega success, you guys are operating now in different countries, different currencies. How do you deal with that? I mean, that sounds like madness.
it unfolds all the problems. But I think like when it comes to markets, we have just chosen a very conservative approach. So for us, every market is like a new marketing channel at the end, right? It's similar to like a Google campaign. You just say, well, I try something out and either it pays off or it doesn't. So we hire usually only one or two people, especially in Europe. You have so many different markets. We have core markets, but it's usually you hire two people and then you give them a specific time frame and see if they start paying off. And otherwise, we also had markets where the head was not perfect. So we just decided to shut down the market, wait 6 to even 12 months to hire someone who really is a game changer for the company. And that was a very big learning. But we never said, for example, build big offices in France, hire 10 people. Like it's really really bootstrap mindset. So this is, I think, where even though we have a broad reach and we can also do a lot of cross-border things, at the same time, we always stayed quite conservative and always follow our higher spending clients, but at the same time, try to really get market access through then our partners. So I think that is where we could, of course, have more complexity if we would be more aggressive in these markets. And the second part, I think multi-currency is something where it sounded easier than it was to launch it because the liquidity flows behind that are just very complicated because we can not only offer them, we also can lend them, but you always need to do cash calls and these kind of things and to build books in all of these currencies so that you have a well utilized facility is tricky, and we are not yet. We just announced it. It will take some time to say that we have deployed in all of these currencies, but that it's things that when someone tells you he has 11 currencies and this currency takes 2 days longer to send, but Visa wants that in one day earlier. What do you do now, right? And that's something you go through every currency.
So now let's put you into a time machine. And let's say I bring you back to end of 2018, when you were thinking about starting something of your own, becoming a founder, take ownership of your own future and destiny. And let's say you're able to appear right there, right now, with your younger self. And you're able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think it would be mainly patience. So a lot of times as a founder, you push, and it not only takes a toll on yourself, because of course, being stressed or trying to push, being impatient. That is something that also not only eats at the people around you or feeds from the people around it, also takes your own part, or you also give a lot for it. So some of these things where it is not necessarily like believing in like, or like being having faith to do something, but quite often you have to really say, like, okay, this might take longer than you expected, and that's fine, right? It sounds like something easy, but I think all founders are usually quite impatient, right? Because they also know there's a wall I'm running, and I'm running fast, but sometimes you really have to slow it down, and that's something that I still try to this day, and I think my co-founder and some others would still say, we're not very good at it yet, but that's a skill you really need to develop as early as possible. Also, if you become someone who has a lot of people in the company, you have to present that, because if you're like the chicken without a head, then you will only hire people like chickens without heads.
I hear you, Malte. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can just find me at LinkedIn. So I don't think there's anybody else with that name so far, maybe in the future. My son has a different name. I wondered I couldn't name him Junior. My wife wasn't happy about it.
That's amazing.
Well, she's American.
It happens. Well, hey, Malte, you know, thank you so, so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.